This is Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the free weekly financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Macro Voices is all about the brightest minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics telling it like it is, bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Aaron Chan.
Macro Voices episode 23 was recorded July 21st, 2016. I'm Eric Townsend. The man who first exposed U.S. equity markets as being rigged in favor of high-frequency trading firms will be joining me as today's feature interview guest. Some of you probably think I'm talking about best-selling author Michael Lewis, whose 2014 book, Flash Boys, told this story. But you'd be mistaken. Market microstructure expert Eric Scott Hunsader, founder of market data purveyor Nanex LLC, actually exposed this story fully 5 years earlier than Mr. Lewis's book and was finally awarded a $750,000 SEC whistleblower award for his work last year. Eric and I will be discussing market microstructure, latency arbitrage, internalizers, the new IEX stock exchange, and much more.
And I'm Aaron Chan. Last week's equity market surprised a lot of observers, breaking out to new all-time highs, and Eric opined that they probably have further to go on the upside. Sure enough, we reached even higher highs this week. So Eric, what's your take on the stock market?
Yeah, we touched 2170 on E-mini futures, which was a new all-time high last night, traded down a bit this afternoon, Thursday afternoon, about 2155, as we're taping near the end of the New York cash session. I think it's basically the same story I described last week, which is we've got the cleanest dirty shirt argument, and as the U.S. dollar continues to strengthen, that potentially woos in more international investors who see a strengthening dollar as a double whammy for their investments originally denominated in foreign currencies, because they're exposed both to the strongest equity market in the world and to the currency appreciation potential if the U.S. dollar rally continues. So I do think that it has farther to go. Now, don't get me wrong, it's not because I think we have a fantastic, healthy economy and everything is great. Quite the opposite is true. What I think is driving this is that things are much worse everywhere else. There is a very real risk that Europe could plunge into a breakup of the European Union. We have a lot going on. China's economy is awful. Situation in Japan is pretty crazy. So we've got the best-looking shirt in a very dirty laundry pile, and we've also got the dollar appreciation angle. I think those are the things that are driving it. I predict that this will eventually end very, very badly, but there's no reason to think that the end is nigh. I don't think that there's anything on the horizon that tells me it's all about to come falling apart. Now, I certainly don't discount the possibility that we could have a crash, as some people are predicting, but you know, last week people were saying, oh, this move to new all-time highs was a very temporary one-day, you know, head fake, and the big crash is coming. Well, it hasn't come yet, and I really don't see any imminent proximal trigger that would cause it to come immediately. I'm not saying it can't happen, but I don't see it happening right now. So I'm not trading equities at all. If I were to do so, it would be with call options because, you know, you've got exposure to upside if this craziness continues, and I do think it's craziness, but you can't lose more than the maximum that you invest in the option premium. And right now, the VIX, which is a measure of the premium on options on the S&P 500, is pretty darn cheap. It's below 11, I think, and really offers an opportunity to make that bet with a reasonable cost of that optionality.
Yeah, Eric, that's definitely a trade I'm looking at as well. Interesting you mentioned that. Crude oil still looks pretty weak. Eric, last week you observed that the 4 million barrel build on distillate inventories, which consists primarily of diesel fuel, jet fuel, and home heating oil, was crazy for this time of year, even in the face of modest drawdowns in nationwide crude oil stocks. So how did this week's inventory numbers look?
Well, we saw another drawdown of 2.3 million barrels against national crude oil inventories. It was a drawdown, but the thing is, for this time of year, it's expected to be a drawdown, and it's a modest-sized drawdown. It wasn't a dramatic one or anything. But the big story was the 911,000 barrel build on gasoline inventories. Several weeks in a row now of gasoline inventories building. This is happening smack dab in the middle of summer driving season. This is the time of year that you would expect those gasoline inventories to be drawn down because consumers are using a lot of gasoline. Remember that distillates, which actually were drawn down slightly this week, those are used for things like trucks and airplanes and other things that are not as discretionary. Gasoline is the more effective proxy for the attitude of the U.S. consumer. Gasoline is not selling. It says that the U.S. consumer is concerned about the economy and not wanting to spend money on weekend trips to the mountains or the lake or the beach or whatever it is that they might be doing. We did see a 214,000 barrel draw in distillate inventories this week. That's nothing compared to the 4 million barrel build that we had last week. So at least it's going in the right direction, but only by tiny amounts. Cushing, Oklahoma, build on crude oil inventories of 189,000 barrels. Now, that's not a huge build, but still, this time of year, any build is out of whack. It doesn't make sense. So we need to make more space in Cushing, Oklahoma, before we get to the fall maintenance season when refineries shut down for a few weeks in order to convert their systems from summer blends of gasoline to winter blends of gasoline. How are we going to make that space if we're already approaching August and there haven't been any dramatic drawdowns? Only very small drawdowns. This week, Cushing was a small build. Crude prices have been correcting back to the downside. They corrected sharply at first in reaction to the inventory news. Then they recovered, probably because they were already fighting with key technical support. But they've rolled back over again this afternoon. I won't be surprised if we take out $44 in the next few days. And I think it'll be a quick ride from there down to 40, because that was a key technical support level around 44.20 or so. Meanwhile, the spreads, that is the difference in price from 1 month to the next month, as you look at the different delivery months out into the future, those spreads are widening, and that widening is concentrated right around fall maintenance season. This, again, says to me that the market is getting concerned about what could happen as we get to fall maintenance. Is there an inventory crisis of some kind on the horizon? That is the key question. The spreads suggest that perhaps there is. Meanwhile, U.S. production hasn't fallen off a cliff like so many pundits predicted that it would, and the rig count is rising as shale drillers go back to work and continue drilling more wells. So I do think that in terms of the big picture here, prices are headed lower. I think there's going to be sometime around fall maintenance season, there's going to be that epic low moment that will be the buying opportunity. Is it going to be an even lower low than the $26 price that we saw this spring? I don't know. I doubt it, but it is possible. I do think, though, that whatever low we have this fall will probably be the final low for a while, and I think the market will rebalance next year and will eventually move to higher prices. So I'm going to be looking for buying opportunities in the energy space this fall.
Great. So shifting to the shiny yellow metal, Eric, last week you said that the key price levels to watch for technical breakouts in gold would be 1308 to the downside and 1377 to the upside. So how's it looking for gold this week?
Well, we saw almost a retest of that 1308 level. I think in the last couple of days we traded as low as 1310, bouncing today back up to 1330 and change, nowhere close to 1377. Will we see it roll back over again? I don't know, but I feel like we don't have any deterministic answer until we break out of that range one way or the other. The fact that there was a bounce off of 1310 doesn't surprise me at all. A lot of people were looking at that 1308 level, not just me. The fact that a lot of people interpreted it as a buying opportunity and a low doesn't surprise me. The fact that it bounced so quickly all the way up to 1335 surprises me a little bit. That's a little more strength than I was expecting, but I still won't be surprised if it rolls over and eventually trades below 1300.
What about the U.S. dollar index? Last week, you observed that the 61.8 Fibonacci retracement level was around 97. Now, we saw the DXY hit 97.37 on an intraday basis during the overnight session Tuesday into Wednesday this week. So what's your outlook for the dollar?
Well, as we're taping on Thursday afternoon, I see we're back to a 96 handle, although it's a high 96 handle. We did get very briefly above 97, but we haven't seen a breakout above that level that's been sustained. I think it's headed in that direction. I think that we probably will see that, but am I going to buy it here when it's sitting right on what technicians' chart looks like a resistance level? No, I don't think so. So 61.8 fib retracement, if we break materially above that and stay there, I might consider buying the DX at that point, because I think from there the prognosis would be it gets at least 100% retracement back to just over 100, and frankly, I think the rally would continue from there. Some people have opined that maybe the Fed is trying to manage the dollar index and keep it in a 95 to 97 range. Perhaps that's true. I don't know. I'm kind of waiting to see what happens.
So finally, Eric, the 10-year U.S. Treasury yield hit a new all-time series low of 1.37% a few weeks ago. And last week, we observed that it had regained 1.5%, and this week, we're close to regaining 1.6%. Are we on the way back to that comfort zone you've described in the past, above 1.7%, which you and others have described as a credibility level for the Fed?
Well, that is the key question, to be sure, and I'm watching it closely. I think we touched 1.58 a couple days ago. I'm showing 1.56 on my screen right now on Thursday afternoon. So basically, in the wake of Brexit, it's no surprise at all that we saw the 10-year Treasury yield trade as low as it did. That's just an indication of flight capital coming out of Europe into the U.S. dollar and into U.S. Treasuries, which are considered a safe haven investment by a lot of investors around the world. So is that capital flow going to continue to support this, or are we going to see it roll back over again? I really don't know the answer yet. I don't think from a technical analysis standpoint, we've seen enough action in the tape to tell us. If we do roll over now that the Brexit is behind us and we can't blame it on Brexit anymore, and we again retest or even move below that 1.37 level, that really sends a pretty ominous message about what may be on the horizon in terms of the economy.
Great. So thanks for the market update, Eric. This week's featured interview guest is Eric Hunsader of market data supplier Nanex. I think you guys are really going to be fascinated by this one. Eric Scott Townsend's interview with Eric Scott Hunsader is coming up as Macro Voices continues, right here at macrovoices.com.
And now, with this week's special guest, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Many people credit Michael Lewis with breaking the story of markets being rigged in favor of high-frequency traders back in 2014 with the release of his book Flash Boys. But in reality, it was Eric Scott Hunsader who broke this story fully 5 years earlier, way back in 2009. I first became aware of Eric's writings on the subject in late 2009 from my friend Brian Brown, who wrote Chasing the Same Signals, one of the first books on algorithmic trading. And I've been following Eric's work ever since. Eric won a $750,000 whistleblower award from the SEC last year for his research showing that the New York Stock Exchange had broken the law by selling accelerated data feeds to high-frequency trading firms. Eric, thanks so much for joining us on the program today.
Thanks for having me.
I want to, before we get started, just lay out a little bit of background for our listeners who may not be familiar with Regulation NMS. Prior to the adoption of Reg NMS back in 2007, investors traded stocks on one stock exchange at a time. The whole idea behind Reg NMS was to tie together about 10 different stock exchanges, and the advantage would be that investors could simultaneously tap the effective collective liquidity of all those exchanges in order to get the very best possible price for their transactions. Regulators termed this retail price improvement. Now, as a former distributed software systems architect, I've looked at Reg NMS, and it's very clear that the entire design theme centers on one core concept called the SIP, or Securities Information Processor, normally pronounced SIP for SIP. The whole point of the SIP is to level the playing field so that all traders get price quotes from the same source at the same time, and nobody has any unfair advantage over anyone else. That's the whole point of what Reg NMS is designed to do. Eric, I'd like to walk through the entire timeline leading up to your whistleblower award, because it just boggles my mind, frankly. Exactly 6 years ago today, on July 21st, 2010, you published clear incontrovertible evidence that you had uncovered proving that the New York Stock Exchange was breaking the law in violation of Reg NMS by selling a faster data feed to high-frequency trading firms, bypassing the SIP and allowing the high-frequency traders to front-run orders that were being processed in accordance with the law. Is that right?
That's right.
Now, before we go on, let's explain why there's an advantage there. What is latency arbitrage, and why is it advantageous for a high-frequency trader to get information just a millisecond or two before everyone else gets it?
It's all about riskless trading, where they have both sides of the trade already locked in when the trigger is pulled. So, I mean, they already know the price, which price is stale and which price is not, and simply capturing that difference. And or a lot of it also has to do with the rebate.
And I know that one of the things that I think is a great misconception in this field is people will tell you, well, high-frequency trading improves the market because they tighten the bid-ask spreads and provide more liquidity. But if I understand this correctly, it's actually true that if I'm a retail trader and let's say a XYZ stock is offered at $10 even, I like that price. I say, I'll buy 1,000 shares at the market. Literally, what happens is the data feed that's going to the high-frequency traders is faster than the SIP. The high-frequency trader who was making that offer at $10 sees my market order coming. He can actually front-run it, change his offer price to, let's say, $10.10, and I end up paying the higher price because he actually beat me to it. It's almost like a kid holding a bone out to a dog, and just as the dog jumps, he pulls it away. Is that right?
Well, yes. So you have to. Your order has to go to multiple exchanges now. In the past, there was only one place for it to go, and so really it couldn't be electronically front-run. I mean, you couldn't see it and do anything about it because it's just one exchange, but now that it has to go to multiple exchanges, as soon as it executes that, the first couple exchanges, the HFT algo will statistically say that, you know, the chances are this order is going to appear in the other exchanges soon. Go out and cancel them or raise them, or even worse, you know, take a position in the same direction because an order is about to appear.
So they might front-run me and buy the stock at $10 only so that they can turn around and sell it to me for $10.05 a millisecond later.
Machines don't mind waiting.
Now, you made these allegations in July of 2010. You had an opportunity on October 10th of 2010. You were on stage at a financial event in Toronto with Larry Leibovitz, who at the time was COO of NYSE. And Eric, please don't take offense, but I think that Mr. Leibovitz, probably in terms of stagemanship and charisma, probably won out on that day. He portrayed you to be the crackpot nutcase conspiracy theorist who had crazy ideas and said very, very clearly that nobody gets data ahead of anybody else. Is that right?
Yeah, basically, yes. I mean, he's Jon Stewart's brother, the comedian, and you know, Larry Leibovitz, COO of NYC at the time, he's got the same charisma gene, and he's very good at speaking. And I was a little thrown off by it because I'm a data wonk. I'm a engineer. I write code all the time. Since the 80s, and I just wasn't used to people just flat out telling lies, especially in front of an audience where after time, I could go back and prove that, you know, what he said was incorrect. I wasn't prepared for that, so it kind of threw me off.
So that was fall of 2010. Fast forward a couple of years, September of 2012, New York Stock Exchange was fined $5 million for doing exactly precisely what you had accused them of doing 2 years earlier in 2010. But this is the really crazy part. They paid the fine. They paid the $5 million. It sounds like a huge amount of money. Like, boy, they really lost out on that day. In reality, the law firm that defended them has actually claimed that as one of their major victories, that they got off for only $5 million. And you allege that they have continued to this day to do exactly the same thing that they were fined for. So it's like they paid the fine, they got their wrist slapped, but never stopped breaking the law. Is that right?
Right, and it's not just the NYC. It's the other exchanges, too. I mean, they're all doing, it's all the same. They're all doing.
So they all continue to break the law, to violate Reg NMS. 6 full years ago, you published proof that this was happening. Eventually, they get slapped with a $5 million fine. They just apparently paid that as a simple cost of doing business and went right back to doing the same thing. October 8th of 2013, you actually went to the trouble of publishing a paper in case the folks at the SEC were having a hard time understanding how to prove that this was still going on. You gave them step-by-step instructions for what to do using their new MITIS system. And this is another interesting sideline. The last time I interviewed you, the problem was SEC didn't know how to enforce any of this, and they were just putting an RFP out in order to get some kind of system that would help their enforcers to see what was happening in real time in the markets. What did they do? I think your Encore software, which at the time at least you were giving away for free to anyone who bought data from your company, Nanex, would have probably met all of their needs, but they didn't want something for free because there's no chance if you're giving it away for free, you don't have a budget to give kickbacks to anybody. So they go and spend millions of dollars. Who do they hire to build this system but a high-frequency trading firm?
Right.
So you, on October 8th of 2013, published a paper showing the SEC exactly what they needed to do to prove that the New York Stock Exchange and other exchanges were still violating the law exactly as they had been fined for, exactly as you alleged that they had done back in 2010. Then at some point, someone told you that there's a whistleblower program. So you filled out some paperwork in order to qualify, didn't really know what to expect. A couple years later, in 2015, you get a call from the SEC informing you that you've been awarded a $750,000 whistleblower reward. So you take the money, but apparently the SEC is happy to acknowledge that, okay, you know, Eric Hunsader did give us this information. It led to the $5 million fine. They are in good faith giving you this $750,000 award, which must be very nice. But they're ignoring you as you've continued ever since 2010 to repeatedly wave a banner at regulators and say, guys, they're still doing exactly the same thing. They're still ripping off retail investors one penny at a time by not following regulation NMS. Is that right?
Yeah. Well, I mean, if they don't keep doing it, then the high-frequency traders will lose money, and we can't have that.
Call me cynical, Eric, but my speculation is that it wasn't an accident. I think that they gave you the whistleblower award to shut you up. You've been extremely vocal and extremely critical of SEC, and I think maybe they thought that by giving you this award and paying you off that you would feel inclined not to be so publicly critical. I would say they wasted their money.
I think there was a culture shift at the SEC because the timeline is, so there was one guy in particular who I was told was very much against finding the NYC in the first place because it would open up a whole can of worms, so to speak, of, oh, but all the other ones are doing it too. What are we going to do? And that guy was Greg Berman, who left the SEC at the end of April of 2015, which was 3 months before I got the call informing me of the whistleblower award. I think there's a relationship there. Maybe not directly, but, you know, he was a part of the influence, if you will, against paying the whistleblower or against, you know, any acknowledgement. So I think, and a lot of this also has to do with, the IEX application this year, and the responses coming from the SEC tell me that something major shifted there, where they're seeing things more through my glasses rather than the rose-colored glasses that they've had on all the time. So that's actually good. That would be a very good thing if that is the case, because I've said this from the first day. You know, we have all the regulations we need. All of this is addressed. The rules are clear. It's not fuzzy. It's very black and white. And all it's going to take is, you know, a regulator who just who enforces the existing rules. Now, I'm fine with getting rid of the rules, too. You can't have rules on the books that say, you know, X and then not enforce them, or worse, sporadically enforce them.
Let's get into how this works so our listeners can understand exactly how they're being ripped off a tiny bit at a time. When the high-frequency traders spend lots and lots of money to get these accelerated data feeds, that allows them the advantage you described earlier. They get the information in time that they can change their bids and offers before an order actually hits the exchange. Now, the SIP is the official source of information, and that SIP can run at a reasonably high speed. It was a well-designed piece of equipment in its day, but what these guys actually do, you termed a phrase called quote stuffing. Explain what quote stuffing is and how it slows the SIP down.
All right, so there's two things to keep in mind. One is all machines take some amount of time to process information. It's not a non-zero amount of time. The second thing is networks and machines that process market information on Wall Street, one machine will process a group of symbols. Now, usually those groups are by alpha, so that, for example, all stocks that start with the letter A or B would be processed by machine 1, C and D would be processed by machine 2, and so forth. Combining those two pieces of information means that if I put any extra load or bogus quotes on one of those symbols in that group, the entire group will be affected by will be slowed down, because that machine has to process that information from that stock. So quote stuffing is actually a way to just get a slight advantage over everyone else, because you know what you're doing and the other ones have to filter it out, which takes execution time.
So essentially what's happening is somebody is putting an order maybe away from the market where it's not going to execute. If they're interested in gaming Apple stock, they're going to pick something else that starts with an A. And they're going to say, I'm going to put a quote at $10. No, $9.99. No, $10. $9.99.
Right.
$10. Back and forth, back and forth, back and forth.
Right. Thousands of times a second. Yes.
So this is equivalent, you know, if I'm walking to a meeting in New York City and I'm going to be late, and I don't want to be late because there's a lot of money on the table and there's a penalty if I'm late. If I'm a billionaire, I get on my cell phone and I know the other guys are coming from the airport, so I hire a million college students to drive on the highway and create a traffic jam so that no traffic can get through. I don't care that I just screwed up the whole system for the whole city of New York, but I did get my one guy that I was concerned with to be later than I was to the meeting.
Yeah,
that's essentially what they're doing.
I'll add one more thing, that it doesn't cost the billionaire any money to do this. It's entirely free because he's in the special club.
And the special club of people that have access to the ability to put millions of quotes onto these feeds. And as long as those quotes are far enough away from the market that they don't execute, it costs them exactly nothing to essentially screw up the whole stock market for everybody else in order to get a tiny little bit of advantage so that they can game the price of one transaction.
Sure. Yep. That's what Wall Street does. You know, they figure out a way to profit out of anything.
And let's move on to spoofing. What does spoofing refer to, and how does it work?
Well, spoofing actually is often used by manual traders to fool the high-frequency algos into believing that there's some demand or supply out there that's real, but it actually isn't real. Machines also do this, but you know, in order for spoofing to be effective, the size has to be statistically significant. So, for example, when Sarah was doing it, his algo would suddenly put in an order to buy or sell 2,000 E-minis which is a very large amount, and you know, something that you might see just a few times a day show up, if that. And so that was large enough that the machines, which are just reading the buy and sell orders in the book, say, you know, all of a sudden detect, oh my gosh, there's a whole bunch of interest in here. Statistically, I should go in that direction. And so it fools them into going that direction. Spoofing is not going to cause a market crash or rally or a flash crash or any of those kinds of things. It's simply about really a tick. At the end of the day, it's trying to capture a tick or two, if that.
So effectively what the spoofer is doing is putting a really, really huge order to buy or sell tens or hundreds of millions of dollars worth of something.
Yeah,
but they're putting it away from the market enough.
100 to 1,000 times higher than normal, just really out there.
And they're not putting that at the market. They're using a limit order that's a little bit away from the market. They put the order in. They leave it there for a few seconds so the algorithms can see it. And then they cancel the order so it never happens.
Right.
Okay. Now, one of the counterarguments that's been made, a lot of people would tell you, well, Eric, you know, high-frequency traders are good for the market. They improve retail prices. Retail investors enjoy the benefit of higher liquidity because bid-ask spreads are tighter as a result of high-frequency trading. What's the fallacy in that argument?
Well, first of all, that's just untrue. I mean, if you looked at when Virtue did their IPO, they filed their S-1, and in the S-1 filing, they talked about this, and they put a chart in that showed bid-ask spreads and trading costs over a longer period of time. And what happens is the high-frequency guys, they will latch on to the decimalization that occurred in early 2001, 2002, when we went from eighths or, you know, 12.5 cent spreads to all the way down to penny spreads. And that took place in 2001, 2002, and that's when spreads compressed dramatically. However, high-frequency trading didn't come about until Reagan MS around 2007, about 5 years later. So when they're claiming reduced spreads, they're trying to capture and claim the spread compression that resulted from going from eighths decimals. If you look at what happened since 2007, when the high-frequency firms came into existence, Virtue's own S-1 has this chart that shows that 2006 actually had lower spreads and trading costs than it does today. So 2006 pre-HFT, post-2007 is after they've been around, and spreads have never been as low as before they showed up.
And a lot of these high-frequency guys have perfect trading records. They never lose money ever for one day.
So, you know, that's just, if you're not taking any risk, you're not contributing anything to the marketplace. And really, the exchanges should have noticed this kind of thing and realized, hey, this is a bug in the system that needs to be worked out. Because that risk-free profits can only come from people losing on the other side.
The problem, I think you described it once, is it's nobody is being stabbed in the heart here, but every single trader in the market is being tortured with millions of little paper cuts. They're just tiny.
And the trading costs have never been higher. It's back in the mid to late 90s, I had one of the first streaming charting applications on the internet, and we went from 0 to 10,000 paying subscribers in about 18 months. And paying subscribers, this is on the internet, by the way, and for a customer to be able to watch all stocks in the market with real-time prices, it was we charged less than $100 a month. It's impossible to do that today by an order of magnitude, simply because the fees for all this market data, which most of it is noise, has exploded. Back in 1999, the most stock quotes that you could expect in 1 second of time for all stocks trading, which is about, you know, 5,000 to 8,000 stocks, would be 1,000 in a second. Well, that number, apples to apples, is now 2 million. And
wow.
That back in the late 90s, for those who remember, that was a wild internet bull market when, you know, that was crazy times. And a lot of trading activity, but the number of quotes per second was just 1,000, and today it's millions. And that cost is borne by everybody who has to process market information.
And every retail trader is getting ripped off, but just a penny at a time on every trade because the machines
the price
are so smart.
They're giving you price improvement, too, is phony price as well.
All of this is enabled by the exchanges basically selling higher, you know, illegally selling higher speed data feeds to high frequency traders.
That's right.
Which is
yep.
illegal, has always been illegal. You've proven that they were doing it. They got fined because you proved that they did it, but they keep on doing it today.
Yep.
And there is a mechanism, even when, you know, when the problem is that there's millions and millions of victims and none of them are damaged badly enough to justify bringing a lawsuit, there is a mechanism for society to protect itself, which is the class action lawsuit, where unfortunately the victims never make any money. The lawyers make all the money, but it's an effective deterrent because whoever gets sued ends up paying a fortune and learns their lesson. So you would think if we had anything resembling justice left in this country, that what would happen is some enterprising lawyer would sue these stock exchanges for breaking the law and for essentially selling out their retail customers to the high-frequency traders by selling them these illegal data feeds. Please explain why they are exempt from accountability.
Legal immunity. The U.S. exchanges are SROs, self-regulating organizations, which basically means they self-police. And which also means you can't sue them, for, even if it's what they're doing is egregious. So, you know, so you're stuck between a rock and a... There is no way to solve it without... when you don't have that legal mechanism in place. It's so hard to believe that that we accept this.
It blows my mind, Eric, because, you know, I can understand the concept of a self-regulating organization. Take the American Medical Association. Obviously, if a doctor is accused of, you know, some unethical practice, other doctors are better equipped than the government is to know whether or not he did something wrong.
Correct.
But why in the world would a stock exchange be exempt from accountability under the law as a self-regulating organization? It doesn't make any sense.
You know, when they were police, when it was a single exchange, you didn't have multiple exchanges. You got to remember, the exchange, each exchange only really sees the world from their point of view. Like NYC really couldn't give a rip what's executing on NASDAQ or what happened to that order after it, you know, finished executing there locally. They don't have the information. They don't have the money to pay for the information. They don't have the manpower to analyze it. So they just don't care. And, you know, unless you look at the whole picture, it's really hard to see what's going on. In fact, one of the reasons a lot of academics haven't, you know, come out on this in a big way is the academics, A, can't really afford market data, and that's true. And B, usually, well, I would say 99.9% of all academic papers on high-frequency trading use the same hand-selected data set from NASDAQ from 2009-2010 era, which only includes a small subset of firms tagged as high-frequency trading and only has NASDAQ data. So it's missing data from BATS, from Edge, from ARCA, from NYSE. Basically, it's missing all the information that's necessary to do a proper analysis. And so, I mean, it's just, I feel like we're just a little early on this, and as time progresses, academics will catch up, and hopefully, finally, the regulators will too.
I want to move on now to the subject of internalizers. I think a lot of traders are not aware. They would assume that when they buy or sell a stock, that that transaction occurs on a stock exchange. But in most cases, it doesn't, at least in the case of retail order flow. Companies called internalizers buy up that flow and they execute it off of the stock exchange. Eric, please correct me if I'm wrong, but as I understand the rules, the way this works is they don't have to match a buyer and seller and give them the exact same price. What they can do is fill any order by using any price that occurred on the real stock exchange during the 1 second time interval at which time the trade was executed. Is that right?
That's right. So 99.99% of all retail orders are given a price that's picked out of thin air by the internalizer based on really what they think they can get away with that the customer won't complain about. There, it's not a price. When you go to buy, the price you're getting isn't because somebody wanted to sell you at that price. It's what the internalizer looked at, the current SIP feeds and direct feeds, and decided that that was the appropriate price.
And so if I want to buy 100 shares of Apple stock and you want to sell 100 shares of Apple stock at exactly the same time, these internalizers can legally give me a different price than they gave you, as long as both of those two prices did occur during that 1 second time interval. And keep in mind, these guys have very sophisticated computers. They can very easily game the market in order to cause transactions to occur at wildly different prices during that 1 second time interval.
Absolutely, yes.
They can legally give you a completely different price on the buy side than they gave me on the sell side, and that's totally legal.
Yes, yep, that's
and
right.
What just blows my mind about this, supposedly the internalizers are providing a service because they process all this order flow that doesn't need to occur on the exchange and it makes it better for the world somehow. What blows my mind, if they were providing a service that obviously costs them money in order to run their computers and do this work, they would presumably charge a fee for it. But in reality, the internalizers don't charge the exchanges anything for processing these orders. They pay a huge fee to get the chance to process these orders off exchange because they're making a fortune by not giving buyers and sellers the same prices.
That's right. So it's not the exchanges they're paying. They're paying the retail brokers like Schwab or Fidelity or one of these outfits. They're paying them. We'll pay you so much for each order, we want to execute it for you.
And so there, you know, I've got a service. It's a benefit to you and to your clients. Really, trust me, it is. And I'm willing to pay you money to do this for you, essentially, not only for free, but for me paying you a fee. Don't worry, there's nothing in it for me. There's nothing going on behind the scenes. Don't watch the man behind the curtain.
That's pretty much how it's presented by, you know, outfits like Barron's. You know, retail never had it better, or, you know, these other studies, quote-unquote studies, that you see. Whenever you see retail never had it better, be wary. I mean, the quickest way for them to prove that they're doing a service that's beneficial, that could be checked by third parties, is to simply provide microsecond resolution timestamps for all your trades. So when you look at your trade execution from your firm, it's kind of a litmus test, a rule of thumb I use. The better resolution of timestamp, the more honest broker you got. So if you're getting 1 second resolution timestamps versus a broker that's giving you by the minute, the one at the second is more likely to be giving you the better deal. If somebody's giving you millisecond timestamps, again, I would trust them more than somebody who's only giving you full second.
But so, even if they're giving you, you know, microsecond timestamps, as I understand it, the law allows these internalizers to use any price. It's not when I make my... They have the technology to process my order in real time and give me the price at that one microsecond. But they don't do that. They keep track of what the price is over the entire one-second interval, and they give me the worst price that they can get away with, and it's all perfectly legal.
So now, technically, they're not allowed to do that. They can't have... Their software can't be set up to always choose the worst price. It has to be set up to always choose the price the same way, but not give the investor the worst price. It could be like, you know, some algorithm that takes into some, you know, some other things into account so that it's fair. But, you know, the only way to prove whether they're doing that or not is really to go and inspect code, and I don't think that's ever going to happen.
Well, I think the way to prove how they're doing that is to look at their profitability. What firms are we talking about when we talk about these internalizers?
Oh, I mean, the names are very, very familiar. They were the ones who argued. They were the ones who argued the most vehemently against IEX and wrote numerous comment letters. Met five times. With the SEC, behind closed doors, I'll add, where there's no transcript, we don't know what was discussed, we only know that IEX, this exchange application, was discussed, and the most recent meeting they had was in June with the commissioner herself, again, behind closed doors. That was Citadel doing all of those meetings. And, you know, they've really been the ones who, you know, are claiming retail never had it better, blah, blah, blah. I say the quickest way for you to prove that that's true is provide microsecond timestamp resolutions, you know, for on all your fills, because, I mean, it's not a technical addition. You're simply not truncating off that precision. You already have them. Just stop, you know, changing microseconds to seconds. Those executions. And then a third party can come along and they can go look at those executions and they can tell the brokerage outfit, yeah, these guys are doing a good job for your customers, or no, these guys are ripping your customers off. Until that happens, it's hard for the broker to really know. I mean, they've really got to trust and believe what the other side is saying. And, you know, it's... humans just don't have the immunity to $1 billion coming in the door. I got to do the right thing, right? I mean, that's just not in human nature. So, you know, we had this old saying in the 80s with the Russians, you know, with arms verification. It was trust but verify. And I think that's probably not a bad thing to adopt for Wall Street. You know, we trust you, but we really need to look at that code.
I couldn't agree more. And, you know, just from my perspective, I don't even need to see the code. I look at the profitability of a company like Citadel.
Yeah, that money's coming from somewhere.
The money's coming from somewhere. They're offering a service that ought to cost money to all of the retail broker houses like Fidelity and so forth, but they pay a fee in order to have the privilege of giving this service away for free. Something is going on there. They're making money on this. And the only way they can be making money on it is to be skimming something off the top. So I think it's pretty clear what's going on. I was going to talk today with you about the 2010 flash crash. We don't really have time for that because I want to make sure that we cover the IEX exchange. There is a documentary called Money and Speed that you were featured in. We're going to link that so that our listeners can have access to it. Let's move on now to IEX. It blows my mind. You know, I travel a lot in third world countries where there's a lot of government corruption, and one of the favorite tricks that they use in these corrupt governments is if they finally get somebody who's honest, an actual candidate running for office that wants to end the corruption, all the corrupt politicians work together to label that guy as being corrupt and say he's the one who's corrupt. And I think the same playbook is in use here, because what seems to be going on, I remember just recently, the president of the New York Stock Exchange was on one of the cable networks saying, oh, IEX, they're trying to create a dark pool. They're trying to hide information. They don't want to make information available in the light the way we do. They've got this speed bump idea, which is trying to hide information from the retail investor. Bad. What's really going on here, Eric?
Well, they're just protecting the money machine. I mean, it's that simple. There's the free money ends, and we'll if you had a free money machine like that, you'd throw everything at it to get it to continue on. Delay it. Anything. You know, one more day of it running is that one more day of profits. So that's what's happening. A lot of fear, uncertainty, and doubt is thrown out there. No real studies ever done. Just a lot of, you know, paid off academics and, you know, people who whose reputation isn't that important to them. Who are just, you know, lining up to say, you know, retail never had it better.
So let's explain this speed bump idea. What is it that IEX, a new exchange that just finally received approval from regulators to be a full-on stock exchange, what are they doing different and how does it benefit investors?
IEX will prevent latency arbitrage, which is the situation where, let's say you want to buy 1,000 shares of Apple, but only 100 are offered at NASDAQ, 100 are offered at BATS, 100 are offered at Direct Edge, 100 are offered at ARCA, and the balance is offered at one of the other exchanges. You've got to route that order, or not you, but you know, somewhere down the line has to route that order to all of those exchanges. And as soon as it executes at one or two, that's enough of a signal that the high-frequency traders will get to the other exchanges before that working market order will, and they'll cancel, adjust, or even you know front-run that order. IEX has a speed bump in it that prevents that signal from coming. In other words, as soon as the trade executes an IEX, that high-frequency trader will not know about it until it's too late to act on it.
And how long are they delaying the signal by?
350 millionths of a second. So it's such an unbelievably small period of time. Often in the news, it got, you know, people said milliseconds, which is 1,000 times longer. But 350 milliseconds, which is 1,000 times longer, is the blink of a human eye. So IEX wants to slow it down by 1,000th of the blink of an eye. In other words, it's how long it takes light to travel from Manhattan to where the NYSE Stock Exchange is in New Jersey and back again. That's how tiny a amount of time it is. No one's going to be affected by that. Only the guys who are doing this latency arbitrage bit are the ones who will be affected.
So it's less than 1/2,000th of a second that they are delaying information. And so then you've got the NYSE guy on TV saying, oh, they're trying to hide information from the public so you don't have it. They're a dark pool.
You know, so the NYSE is cracked up because they're the only exchange that uses the SIP exclusively for all their quotes and trades, which, by the way, that's all the exchanges should be doing the same thing. But the NYSE is using it, and, you know, at the same time, you'll hear things, well, the SIP is slow. And the SIP is, because the exchanges don't spend any money to make it state-of-the-art, they're still, you know, decades behind in technology. The SIP is in the hundreds of microseconds slower than the direct feeds. Legally, yes, but that's the kind of time frame that they're slower by. Pretty close to the amount of time IEX wanted to introduce as a speed bump. Yeah, long story short, the NYSE could do much better than, in fact, they have their own speed bumps in place that are just simply not documented and you don't know about, you know, caveat emptor until, you know, you get bit by it. So NYC's got those speed bumps. They've always had those speed bumps. The speed bumps are larger. They're not as, they're not unpredictable, and they're not equal. So some people are less speed bumped than others. Compare that to IEX, which is fully documented, just fully transparent. It's just eye-opening that a CEO would just, you know, would be willing to lay their neck down there on that chopping block like that. It just boggled my mind that the things that he said.
Now, obviously, you're a big fan of IEX and feel that it's going to bring a little bit more justice to the pricing that retail traders get. They just recently received approval from the SEC. So when do they actually go online and start trading at full capacity as an exchange?
They said August 18th, I believe, if that's a Friday. It's the 19th if it's not. They're going to start with a few symbols. and ramp up from there, being fully online in September.
Now, forgive my cynicism, but I really look at how much money from this money machine that has created an unlimited, perfect trading record for these high-frequency trading firms since 2009. There's a lot of people that don't like this thing. Aren't there ways that other exchanges could collude to set IEX up and make them look bad or somehow sabotage them?
That time has passed. You know, the whole thing about exchanges being self-regulating and their own police, now, IEX just joined that club. So they're going to have a hard time doing it. They're not going to be able to do it without IEX saying, being able to document it and, you know, bring, you know, hard evidence to the SEC. I mean, one of the biggest things that IEX brings to the marketplace is the speed bump is the thing that's talked about a lot. But the one big thing to me is you finally have somebody with integrity who has power to affect change. I mean, they're an SRO, and they've got a channel straight into the SEC. And you can't simply say, you know, the data that IEX is bringing is faulty. I mean, it's coming from an SRO. It's by default, these guys are, you know, already coming with credibility. The biggest benefit will be shared by all in the marketplace, and that is increased transparency, because now you've got, for the first time, you know, a firm with integrity who's got SRO status. They're a member of the club. They're now going to be going to these, the backroom SIP meetings where, you know, they discuss things about SIP performance and that kind of thing. No longer hidden from view. The world has changed, and I'm not sure people fully realize that. I haven't been talking about that too much until after IEX became an exchange, because I just didn't want, frankly, I didn't want, you know, to wise up a chump. I figured let that one be, you know, quietly. We didn't need that to get more people to want IEX to be an exchange. We didn't want to get any more pushback from it or panic from the other side. Perhaps that's now sinking in, and you're starting to see some of the, I mean, that might explain that crazy NYSE CEO's interview on, it was either Bloomberg or one of those, or CNBC, where they're just saying outlandish things, you know, trying to now plant in people who make routing decisions, plant in their mind that don't favor the IEX exchange. IEX is bad. Don't go there. That kind of thing, which is not going to work. Because at the end of the day, the way the market works is it's going to find the lowest cost. And they're fighting a losing battle there. But the biggest gain is we now have a seat at the table. We being, you know, investors or, you know, the non-high-frequency trading, the people not in the HFT club.
Unfortunately, we have run out of time. I had quite a few other questions I wanted to ask you about flash crashes and mini flash crashes and so forth. We're going to have to save that for another time. I do want to cover one more point, though, which is, you know, you've since 2009 really been almost obsessed with kind of being a do-gooder and doing the right thing in the marketplace and calling attention to a lot of crazy things that go on. Your website, nanex.net, is full of all kinds of color charts and graphs that show liquidity drying up at certain points in time and various apparently illegal activities going on in the market. And you've been an incredible volunteer watchdog for the benefit of other investors, which I really salute you for, Eric. But you do also run a business. You are the founder of Nanex LLC, which is a market data provider. You publish 20 billion with a B data points of market information every single day. And I know from personal experience, I made the mistake once of thinking that I wanted to buy, I was doing research on a crude oil trade, and I needed a lot of tick level data going back several years. I foolishly thought that the exchange, being the official source, was the best place to buy it, and I later discovered that your company offers far higher quality and more complete data sets than the exchanges do for their own data. So tell us just a little bit about what you do at Danex and where some of our institutional clients who are interested in those products can find more about it.
Right. We are market data. We understand market data probably better than most people out there. I've been doing market data exclusively since the mid-80s. I've seen it all. We work with exchanges in spite of, you know, myself calling them out in public. They still do contact us and want to work with us because they know at the end of the day we're going to find what they're looking for that others might miss or might not pick up on. So if it has anything to do with market data, whether it's sub-second or it's even longer term, we've got every time and every tick, every quote, every trade back to 2003 for everything in the U.S., including the options market, which is just an enormous amount of pile of information. Our business is all about working, taking that pile of information and doing something meaningful without having to be a rocket scientist.
Well, fantastic, Eric. I cannot thank you enough for giving us this interview today. Aaron Chan will be joining me again as Macro Voices continues right here at macrovoices.com.
Thanks for having me.
Macro Voices is a listener-driven program. Please email requests for specific future interview guests to requests@macrovoices.com. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com. And we'll answer them on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. We also welcome your suggestions for how we can improve the program. Now, back to your hosts, Eric Townsend and Aaron Chan.
So that was a great interview with Eric Hunsader, and it's really illuminating to get the microstructure perspective on the market. You know, I was first attracted to Macro Voices because I love the high-level discussion on oil, interest rates, currencies, central bank policy, and macroeconomics. But really, as I continue to learn as a trader and an investor, and also for my own intellectual enrichment, I think it's important that we continue to offer broad perspectives on the market. So, Eric, I guess good guys do finish first sometimes, at least in Eric's case.
Well, I guess so. You know, with the IEX exchange gaining approval to be an exchange, that's why we wanted to get Eric on. We tried to get Brad Katsuyama from IEX on as well, and unfortunately, Brad didn't respond to our emails. But yeah, you know, it's funny. I really believe that SEC's intention with that whistleblower award was to shut him up and get him to stop being so critical of SEC. And I would say that they wasted their $750,000.
Well, you know, you asked Eric if he thought that the big players would set up IEX for failure. And now that the good guys are on the same playing field as the cheaters, you know, how do you see this market dynamic playing out?
Well, I just look at this, and pardon my cynicism, folks, but there is a huge, huge engine of power and political influence in the high-frequency trading arena. The amount of money that these people have donated to politicians in order to secure control is just out of sight. And they have had this risk-free party with perfect trading days, and that party has gone on for 8 years now. IEX is set to totally screw things up for these guys, and I don't expect them to go down without a fight. So I would imagine that any dirty trick imaginable is in their future. If I were Brad Katsuyama, I would literally be concerned for my personal safety. I mean, you know, they could take this guy out in order to get rid of IEX. And I think that IEX is the hero in this story, but sometimes nice guys don't finish first, and I'm afraid that they are going to disrupt and threaten a very, very powerful institution, which has been very corrupt for a long time.
Well, we certainly hope that nothing happens, or at least nothing bad happens to Eric and Brad. Speaking of dirty tricks, you know, there was a lot of technical jargon in the interview, and not on purpose, but even though a substantial portion of our listener base are sophisticated institutional investors, I want to get back to your discussion on internalizers for a second. You know, Eric, how can our listeners, be they institutional or retail, start thinking about avoiding getting fleeced on each trade that they make?
Well, the problem is you only get fleeced for a dollar or two in every trade. It's just these small adjustments that they make by front-running trades and, you know, adjusting your actual fill price by a few cents away from what it should have been. And so you're getting fleeced by a little bit. I don't think you can avoid it. You know, if you're a retail investor, your broker is going to go through one of these internalizers, and they are making money. The only possible way that these companies like Citadel can make as much money as they do, which is a lot of money, is to take advantage of being able to match trades in a way that they come out ahead somehow, even though they're paying for the privilege of running this order flow. So I don't think you can beat it. Using the IEX exchange would be the way to beat it. And I wouldn't be surprised, as I said in the interview, if they get set up somehow. And I don't know exactly what that will be. But, you know, if you hear headlines about how IEX turned out to be a fraud and it's all a big conspiracy, my first thought would be they got set up.
Yeah, well, I mean, their breadbasket is at stake. A lot of people have said that high-frequency trading helps with liquidity in the market. And it's too bad we didn't have enough time, or you didn't have enough time, to dive deeper into that topic with Eric. You know, actually, as you were discussing high-frequency trading, one Rajiv Fernando actually came to mind. Does that ring any bells?
Yeah, it's important because people will say, you know, that high-frequency trading, it only costs you a few cents. You know, each trade only costs a little bit. So this Rajiv Fernando guy basically purchased himself a seat on the International Security Advisory Board, which comes with like the highest level of security clearance that there is.
That's right.
The guy had zero qualifications, none whatsoever. He's not a security advisor. He's not an expert on anything. He just donated enough money to Hillary Clinton to get himself put on this board. Was his intention to try to get access to top secret government information so that he could front run it somehow with his high frequency trading outfit? We don't know what his motivations were. Eventually, after the whole Hillary Clinton email scandal thing, the guy kind of quietly resigned from this board before there was too much of a stink about it. But, you know, these high frequency trading guys are making an absolute killing. They're ripping off the entire market, and they're buying positions on senior government boards of advisory that have direct access to the President of the United States. This is dangerous, dangerous stuff.
Yeah, definitely dangerous, but hopefully with what Brad and Eric are doing, those days are numbered. So Eric, last thing. Eric describes some of IEX's main differentiators, including the implementation of speed bumps to prevent latency arb, and increased transparency via micro timestamp resolution. But how defensible are these advantages, and what's stopping the other exchanges from adopting the similar technologies or mechanics?
Well, I think it's a good thing if they do. I mean, remember that those things are preventing latency arbitrage from working. So I think the big question is, which way does this go? If IEX is successful, the word will get out to investors that you're not getting ripped off, and it's only pennies at a time. Will investors even care enough to make the change and insist that their orders be routed to IEX? If they do, the other guys are not going to lose market share, so they will implement the same features that will disable the efficacy of high-frequency latency arbitrage trading, and it will prevent these guys from ripping us off in this particular way. If that happens, I would just be watching to see, you know, what are the stock exchanges going to sell us out to next if it's not high-frequency traders.
Well, Eric, that's all. I think that's all the time we got for questions this week.
Well, folks, I really want to ask everyone. We don't want your money, but we do need your help. We're reaching the six-month point, which my mentors in talk radio tell me is when you start to really get traction. We need to get a name made for Macro Voices so that we can start to attract more of the high visibility names that you want as guests on the program. So please continue to help us. Register at macrovoices.com. You'll receive our free research roundup email, as well as helping us, because the more registered users we have, that's a bigger statistic that we can tell to people that we're trying to recruit as guests on the program. You can help us by retweeting the announcements when we announce that the show is out and telling your friends and colleagues about Macro Voices. Aaron, for people who have registered at macrovoices.com, what can they expect in this week's Research Roundup email?
Yeah, thanks, Eric. So this time of the year, we've got a lot of fund managers and investors coming out with second quarter or even first half letters. So this week, we've got the latest quarterly review from Dr. Lacey Hunt and Van Hoisington of Hoisington Investment Management. We've got fan favorite Art Berman's latest comments on crude oil. And for those of you interested in gold and silver, which I know is a lot of you, I found an interesting note penned by Jennifer Thompson of Gabakel Capital detailing the divergence from the traditional relationship between the gold-silver ratio and European stocks. And lastly, Dana Lyons produced some interesting statistics dating back to the year 1900 on how the Dow Jones has never made a market top in July when looking at a 12-month forward basis. So there's that and a lot more to look forward to in this week's packed research roundup. Well, so that does it for us this week. I know this may sound like a broken record at this point, but we really appreciate all the support we've gotten so far. Be it retweets, mentions, forwarding our research roundup emails, every bit helps us reach a larger audience of sophisticated investors, which ultimately helps us to get the high-profile guests that you want. I also know that quite a few of our listeners write their own analysis, and I'd like to invite those of you who do write to share your analysis with our community via the Research Roundup email. If you're interested, email us your article at researchroundup@macrovoices.com or tag your article with the MVRR hashtag on Twitter. You can follow Eric at Eric S. Townsend or myself at @AaronChan_ for the latest news on Macro Voices or general market commentary. Also, don't forget to follow our main account at Macro Voices. For Eric Townsend, I'm Aaron Chan. Chat with you next week.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Please register your free account at www.macrovoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly research roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week, which never includes advertising or marketing. You'll also gain access to our free listener discussion forums and research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we're able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can also subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week, free of charge. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer your questions on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts, Eric Townsend and Aaron Chan, shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit macrovoices.com.